Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, I-17 eastbound, the exit ramp at 7th Avenue is blocked. Elsewhere, a crash blocking the shoulder on the 101 southbound at Broadway in the East Valley. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Clear skies tonight with overnight lows in the upper 60s. Sunny in 93 tomorrow, up to 95 on Thursday. Sunny skies over Phoenix. It's 90 degrees right now at KJZZ. Some students are finally returning to their old classrooms after severe storm damage closed down their schools almost 3 weeks ago. KJZZ's Catherine Fritke reports.
The closure affected more than 3,200 students in the Safford Unified School District. All six of those district schools shut down after a severe rain and hailstorm caused flood and other structural damages. Five of those schools are finally reopening. School Superintendent Ken Van Winkle says it's nice that things are returning to normal.
We're in school, and I think parents are happy. For the most part, kids are happy, although I think they did like the little break. We are happy to have them back.
One of the elementary schools has not reopened, but Van Winkle says those students will be attending classes at other schools for a few more weeks. Catherine Fricke, KJZZ News.
Early voting is well underway in Arizona and a number of other states in advance of Election Day on November 8th, and some of those voters are casting their ballots online. But a new investigation from the program Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting looks at how secure internet voting is, and perhaps not surprisingly, it found just as emails can be hacked, so can voting systems. Byer Duncan is with Reveal.
The focus of my story is internet voting, which is allowed in more than 30 states and is mostly reserved for military and overseas voters, though a couple states do allow it for everyone. The central issue that I identified was that of the 11 or so states that are identified as swing states, five of them allow internet voting. And we're talking about thousands of ballots being cast over the internet that security experts warn are insecure and subject to hacking, subject to tampering.
We've been hearing for years and years and years about how voting machines are either outdated or they don't work. We all remember, you know, the Chad situation in Florida in 2000. In some ways, is internet voting just another extension of voting machines that may or may not actually work properly?
One thing that's ironic about this issue is that a lot of the security experts that I talked to when asked about internet voting, you know, these are people who live their lives on the internet, and there's this near unanimous chorus from them that is saying, get it offline, do it on paper, you know, do it the old-fashioned way.
But even when it was on paper, that wasn't always the most accurate thing.
That's true. One concern that some of these experts have raised with me is that, of course, there's really no perfect system, but the susceptibility of a sort of rapid, wide-scale assault on ballots as they travel over the internet is the primary concern of many of these experts who say that hackers are incredibly sophisticated right now, and intercepting and altering them on a large scale is something that can be done quickly.
Do these online voting systems tend to have any kind of paper trail if there needs to be a recount or another investigation?
There's a patchwork of requirements for whether or not to have a paper trail. It's sort of state by state. But in a lot of cases, sort of the appeal is that there is no paper trail. You know, like this isn't essentially a way to expedite the voting process for military and overseas voters who don't necessarily have access to a place to mail their ballot. And that is kind of the thinking in a lot of these cases.
Did you get the sense, and do security experts think that this is an issue of elections officials just not having the expertise or their offices not having the expertise? Or do they think that there just is not a way to adequately secure something like online voting?
The security experts I spoke to basically are unanimous in their opinion that fully securing online voting, in other words, making it completely tamper-proof, completely hack-proof, is at this current stage of internet technology impossible. And one of the main reasons for that, frankly, is that securing an online voting system, if you're going to guarantee that it's 100% secure, would mean securing every home computer from which people are voting.
Would we know if ballots had been tampered with necessarily?
To know if ballots had been tampered with when they arrive at an election office, it would require a degree of expertise that most election officers don't possess. You know, hackers can be quite adept at covering their tracks, at ensuring that the votes appear essentially unchanged, untampered with when they arrive at the elections office.
That almost seems like the bigger problem here, that votes might be altered or tampered with and election officials could have no idea and think, hey, the system worked great. Let's just keep doing this.
That is one of the main concerns, I agree. And one of the fundamental differences between this and, for example, online banking is if there's a detection of fraud, if there's some sort of funny business happening with your online bank account, your bank wastes no time in just simply calling you and saying, hey, this looks suspicious. What's going on? Did you spend money on this thing? When it comes to online voting, your election officer can't exactly call you up and say, hey, you're a registered Democrat, but it looks like you voted for Trump. Or, hey, you're a registered Republican, and it looks like you voted for Hillary. Did you change your mind? You know, that's not how our system works. We're guaranteed a secret ballot. And so your election officer can't put the same safeguards in place that a bank could.
Byer Duncan, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Byer Duncan is with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Arizona voters passed Proposition 123 in May, and millions of dollars have already been doled out to schools. But Maricopa County school districts are still trying to pass bonds and overrides to increase funding. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Casey Kuhn reports how Prop 123 could cast a shadow as voters cast their ballots.
20 school districts in the county have bonds or overrides up for a vote this year, an effort to counteract huge cuts to education funding from the state legislature since 2009.
Recently, what we did for the teachers is
the Pendergast Elementary School District, serving West Phoenix and some West Valley cities, is one of them. Eighth grade volunteers list their latest efforts to parents and community members at a school-sponsored breakfast. Then school officials gave a presentation on the bond.
Yeah, the moment has come to talk about the bond.
The $60 million bond would be used for building maintenance, new school buses, classroom additions, and technology. Community member Stephen Feldman came to the Pendergast presentation and was undecided before he learned more about it.
And I was undecided because I don't want to see the students suffer because of what the administration does or doesn't do.
He also doesn't think the district is being completely honest about the funding, a feeling he says is shared by people like him, older, retired, and with no children in school. Glendale parent Justine Clure understands where that leery feeling comes from.
Previous administration, I think, was just a long-standing rain. It was just kind of, you know, pushing at the, you know, at the minimal passing rate. You know, it was just kind of more focused, not so much on growth for the individual students.
But now she does have children in the schools, and to her, reaching out to the longstanding members of the community is essential to creating more awareness of where the Pendergast district is today.
This district is about the kids, and it's not about anything else but them. And so we've been able to help get people on our side.
And she was the one who invited Feldman to learn more about the bond because she found him opposing it online. Now he's decided to vote yes, but only reluctantly. He doesn't think the school's performance is up to par. Chuck Essigs with the Arizona Association of School Business Officials says polls show voters like Feldman feel the schools need more money even after Arizonans passed Prop 123.
It was only the first step in many steps that need to be made to make capital and operational funding in Arizona more adequate. So I'm pretty optimistic that the voters have gotten that message.
But not all voters understand that. Jeffrey Stachmas, a parent in Tolleson Union High School District, which also has an override on the ballot, has heard some of his peers are confused by the difference between Prop 123 money and potential override money.
They think they're one and the same. They think that the override is maybe an extension of 123.
Prop 123 money comes from state coffers in a settlement to districts. Bond and override funding comes from local property taxes. Stachmas, whose daughter just graduated from the district, thinks the override is worth the tax increase.
It's important that we continue to support our schools, whether we have children in them that are coming up, current students or former students. The strength of our schools will strengthen our communities, businesses, and neighborhoods.
Stachmas, like Pendergast parent Justine Clore, has been active in getting the word out to clear up any confusion on bonds, overrides, and school funding and school spending. And he hopes the community is listening. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
If you look down the ballot, pretty far down, in fact, you'll see a number of candidates for the Central Arizona Water Conservation District. With me to explain what this position is and what people who hold it do is Warren Tenney, executive director for the Arizona Municipal Water Users Association. He was also twice elected to the Central Arizona Water Conservation District. And Warren, first off, what exactly does this job entail?
Well, first off, the Central Arizona Water Conservation District is the organization that oversees the Central Arizona Project. And the Central Arizona Project is the 336-mile canal that brings Colorado River water to Phoenix and Tucson. So basically, the board of directors, which is elected, it's a 15-member board, is responsible for overseeing that canal, for overseeing the infrastructure and all the policies that get involved with making certain that that water is delivered to Central Arizona.
What are some of the kinds of decisions that that board has to make?
Well, the most important ones is dealing with making certain that it's operating. So approving the budget, making certain that the finances are there, which then gets into setting the rates that are then charged to the customers that the water is delivered to. And then there's also making decisions about policies of how does this water work in regards to preparing for a shortage declaration, looking at the energy source that is so necessary for delivering this water because you're actually lifting the water uphill. And there's and numerous other things.
Now, you ran for this position twice. You served on this board. What was the process of running for this job like? Because it's a fairly down-ballot kind of race.
Right. I think the biggest challenge when you run for this board is to explain what is the Central Arizona Water Conservation District, and then explaining that it's talking about the Central Arizona Project, what all is involved with that. So it's a great opportunity to go out and meet people and to educate them about water in Arizona and specifically about the Central Arizona Project.
Now, these races are at least nominally nonpartisan. I mean, the candidates don't have a party affiliation next to their name on the ballot. Do you find that some of the names that maybe are familiar to voters or candidates who maybe voters have known from other political experiences, do those folks tend to have a leg up on this?
Well, you know, name recognition helps in whatever race you're running for. With this race, it's really important that it is nonpartisan. I mean, it doesn't matter what walk of life you have come from, what your political affiliations are, water is important to you, and it really needs to be approached in a nonpartisan way.
It sounds like this is one of those races where a candidate's background and knowledge of the issue might be more important than maybe their political views or plans of what they would like to do in that job.
With all the issues that are before the board of the CAP, it is helpful and useful to have background or information or, most important, a willingness to learn and dig into the issues. Because, unfortunately, water is complicated and there's a lot of factors with it. And so it's real important that the people serving on this board are really digging in and looking at the water issues and have some knowledge on it, because there is a learning curve once you get into that you have to go through when you get elected.
Warren Tenney is the executive director of the Arizona Municipal Water Users Association. He was also twice elected to the Central Arizona Water Conservation District. Warren, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening today. Along with the Takeaways' John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. It's a city of 7,000 in France, and by the end of this week, it'll be no more.
It's the sound of migrants and refugees of the Calais temporary city called the Jungle, packing up their possessions and heading to a government processing center to be sent to different locations around France. The three-day operation will erase the shacks and tents crammed into a 1.5-square-mile camp that can possibly be glimpsed from inside the space-age Eurostar trains traveling the Channel Tunnel, linking France and Britain.
The life here is not good, where I was in the jungle.
But the link between these migrants and the UK is not part of the deal, although many wish it were so.
I will sleep on the street if they remove the camp. I will not move one inch from here. Just I have one hope, is just to get to the UK, and I don't have any other option.
Caroline Gregory has been volunteering for Calais Action for the past year. She says that the somber process of moving once again is underway for these refugees.
Because this has been a while in coming, they're now quite resigned to the fact that the jungle, as it's known, is going to finish. There's also a sense of hopelessness, especially among those who've been here for a long time, maybe up to a year, because they've not managed their goal of getting to the UK, and now they're going to be moved elsewhere in France, where obviously there's no chance at all that they can reach the UK. So among some of them, there is definitely a sense of despair and hopelessness.
Why would it be impossible for them to get to the UK if they have some sort of immigrant papers in France so that they could go and apply in Britain? I mean, is the papers that they're going to receive in France ban them essentially from going to the UK?
If they claimed asylum in France, eventually they would be able to travel to the UK, but the problem is that the asylum system is so backed up that it could take years for their papers to come through. So, of course, if you're young or if you've got, for example, even children in the UK, then you're not going to want to wait.
We're talking to Caroline Gregory, a journalist in Calais, who's a volunteer with Calais Action, taking a look at the destruction of the jungle, the refugee city in Calais of 7,000 or more migrants. And the status of those people is unclear at this point. Caroline, how many people have been moved so far, and what does it look like as you're watching?
It's very difficult to say exactly how many people have been moved because there's no official way of counting who goes in, who goes out, whether they're the same people or not. The French authorities are saying that around 2,000 people have gone on the buses so far, but it's difficult to tell and it's difficult to verify that.
And the actual dismantling of structures, who's responsible for that and how's that going?
That hasn't really begun yet. So there were been concerns overnight that there are still a lot of children in the camp, even children by themselves. So they haven't actually begun dismantling shelters yet. That's expected to start early tomorrow morning.
Have you spoken with kids? What do they say?
Yes, it's been quite concerning the past couple of days. I've spoken to quite a lot of children in there, and they are really, a lot of them are really scared. They don't know. They've not been given proper information by anybody as to what's happening. A lot of them, they don't understand where they're supposed to go to register, and they've been given different information by, for example, the French authorities and the UK volunteers. Some of them are really quite scared as to what their future holds at the moment.
And these are individuals from a variety of countries around the Middle East and North Africa. Give me a sense of the people who you've encountered.
So most of the refugees in the camp are from Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and then Eritrea and Sudan in Africa. Those are the main nationalities. And then there's, you know, some small groups from other places, but those are the main ones.
Have you ever, in the course of your experience there, discovered any sense of radicalization taking place, of individuals who are filled with anger because of their situation and anger that they might take out on their countries of destination?
It's worth remembering that the reason many of these refugees are here is that they are fleeing ISIS, Daesh, and the Taliban. So they are even bigger enemies of ISIS than we are in the West. The only chance that they would ever have becoming radicalized is if the very poor treatment of them here in Europe continues. You know, that's the only thing that I see that could potentially radicalize them.
Caroline, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Caroline Gregory is a journalist in Calais and a volunteer with Calais Action.
Let's you say you have another house for all people, young After that, you go to UK, but I don't know.
Al-Aldia, a 14-year-old Sudanese refugee in Calais, is still holding out hope of making it to London. Over 1,000 unaccompanied minors are still waiting to be processed as part of the jungle's demolition. But where do they go? Answering that question is to take a page from the life of Lord Dubs, Labour Party peer in the House of Lords, who was a refugee from the Nazi takeover of Czechoslovakia in 1939. He was part of the Kinder Transport Program. Lord Dubs says only 200 or so have managed to make it through the human pipeline to the UK.
The world has changed enormously. Attitudes to migration, attitudes to refugees have changed. So we're looking at something that's rather different. But have we learned the lessons of the past? Probably not. In 1938-39, Britain took 10,000 unaccompanied child refugees on the Kinder Transport from Germany, Austria and Czechoslovakia, because I was one of them. And at that time, all other European countries said no. And indeed, even the United States, with your very generous immigration policies at that time, even the United States said no to these children. So they all came to Britain.
And as you've seen the situation in Calais, how would you describe the main differences between then and now?
I suppose anybody who is Jewish, I'm half Jewish, was fleeing the Holocaust. So maybe we were fleeing something even more dreadful, which was the gas chambers. However, I've been to Calais twice, and it is very shocking that in a modern, affluent continent like Europe, we have people living in such dreadful squalor, many young people living in a state of danger, where there are criminals about who can draw them into criminality, prostitution, and so on. So I think it is shocking that we've had the situation in Calais for so long. I'm glad that we're now beginning to do something there.
And what do you make of the insistence that so many of them want to come to the UK?
Well, at one level, it's a little bit puzzling. I think they're saying that chances of getting a job in the UK are greater than getting one in France. I think the people traffickers, some of whom are in the camp in Calais, we believe, have actually said to people, you know, go to the UK. That way they can get some money out of them for helping them across the channel, if that's possible. And partly, I think the authorities, I suppose the French authorities, failed to tell the people arriving in Calais what their rights would be if they stayed in France, their rights to claiming asylum.
You've described how different then is from now. As you look at some of the children in Calais, as you visited, do you see yourself in some of their eyes? Do you see history repeating itself?
Well, you know, it's difficult to describe in words what a dreadful situation it is. Now, look, from my point of view, if I hadn't got out of Czechoslovakia, then I suppose, like a lot of people are Jewish, most people I'd have ended up in the gas chambers. So to that extent, I was escaping a terrible fate. On the other hand, my mother simply put me on a train. I was whisked to England on an interminably long train journey. Now, the ones in Calais have had very long, difficult journeys. Some of them have taken a year to get from Middle East or wherever it is. That's what they've said to me. And they're now living in a state where they don't know what the future holds for them. So their present physical situation is abominable, absolutely shocking.
Tell me the story of someone who described their journey and you got a sense of how long their journey has been.
So this is somebody who actually got to England. He got to England illegally on the back of a truck. He was Syrian. I met him on the outside the parliament. He'd seen his family killed by bombs in Damascus. He'd got to Jordan, decided that there was no future for him in a camp in Jordan, and spent a year traveling from Jordan by the complicated route to Calais, and then got himself on the back of a truck and ended up in London. He was speaking a bit of English, and this is a light-hearted bit of relief. He said to me his ambition was to become a politician, pointing at the Palace of Westminster.
What's your chief worry about the situation in Calais right now and over the next 48 hours?
One of my major concerns is that there's still a lot of children there. They're very vulnerable. Some of them still have the right and can come to this country, and I hope that'll happen quickly. Every day spent there is an intolerable extra day of uncertainty and fear for them. And of course, there's still adults there. And again, they may well be refugees as well, having fled from torture and persecution, threat of torture and death and war and persecution and so on. And I think, frankly, for the people in Calais, it's been a difficult situation because not everybody behaves well, and some of them have behaved rather badly. And the people in Calais also don't want this situation to continue.
The Right Honourable Lord Dubs is Labour Party peer in the House of Lords. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. A recent survey of policing in America shows hundreds of thousands of officers put in millions of hours every year moonlighting, that is, working private off-duty security jobs. But as KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, these part-time jobs can complicate what it means to be a full-time public servant.
At the Marquee Theater in Tempe, Sergeant Steve Carbajal looks on as people go through security before a concert.
People come and have a good time. It's a smaller venue. It's a different vibe, some kind of like not your necessarily always mainstream bands, you know?
Carbajal is moonlighting, working off-duty security to supplement his day job as an officer with the Tempe Police Department. He makes $60 an hour, and he says it's a pretty easygoing crowd. He got the job through an off-duty coordinator at his department.
Here's the jobs. So for Monday, there's three jobs posted here.
Sergeant Josie Montenegro says the off-duty work is so popular that the department doles out the jobs with a lottery system. It's like a bonus or an added incentive for officers.
Especially if they have a young family or, you know, they want to buy a house.
Regardless of what they use the money for, a lot of cops take advantage of the chance for extra income.
As many as 300,000 officers may be putting in more than 43 million hours working for private employers every year.
University of South Carolina legal scholar Seth Stoughton recently completed a survey of off-duty police work. He says moonlighting poses questions about cops using public resources for private gain.
You have someone who was hired and trained and equipped with taxpayer dollars.
Stoughton also found significant variations in policy across the country. For instance, the Orange County Sheriff's Department in California does not allow its officers to work off-duty security. Lieutenant Mark Stichter says their policy prevents internal conflict.
The lines would be gray between are you acting in your responsibility and your role as a full-time law enforcement officer or as a security officer of a private interest.
But Stoughton found the majority of departments allow moonlighting.
It raises a pretty fundamental question about what policing is. Is it public? Is it private? Or is it some mix of the two?
He says for many officers, the answer depends on what day it is and who's paying. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In a check of international news at 2:36, New Zealand has made the bold pledge to be free of non-native predators by 2050. The government has said rats, possums, and stoats, which are short-tailed weasels, kill 25 million native birds each year. New Zealand's Minister of Conservation has warned if the country did not act now, the decimation of native wildlife would only get worse. The BBC's Phil Mercer reports.
They swim, they climb, and they kill. Stoats and other introduced species have had a catastrophic effect on New Zealand. Now the country is fighting back.
Anything with four legs, fur, and teeth has just caused absolute devastation for our native wildlife.
Small, mobile, aggressive.
You talk about the difficulty, the gargantuanness of the goal of making the whole country predator-free. No one would argue with that. It is audacious. It is big.
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Maggie Barry.
I have received advice from DOC which costs out our ability to make parts of New Zealand, including various islands, predator-free.
Eradicating many millions of feral animals is undeniably a bold plan. But it's a challenge that conservation officials are embracing.
The great thing about New Zealand is, for a very small country, we like to think big. I'm Nicola Tukey, and I am the Department of Conservation's Threatened Species Ambassador. We were the first country to give women the vote. We were the first to get up Mount Everest. This is just another one of those goals that we've kind of looked at and said, absolutely, we can do it. And in all seriousness, the science tells us we can.
What we've got here is some stoat bedding. And over the years, we've been trying to find a super lure for stoats because they can be really hard to catch.
At Lincoln University near Christchurch, Dr. Elaine Murphy and her team are working on new techniques to catch and kill pests.
We're just off to see where we house the stoats. And we've also got some rats out here. And then we have a 2-hectare predator-proof enclosure, which is where we trial a lot of our different things, so our lures, and also we're working on light deterrence and looking at how high even stoats can jump.
and we meet one cantankerous stoat used in the university's experiments.
And he is being very aggressive. He doesn't like us being here. He's in a tube in a cage, and he's making his feelings very well known. But this is part of the problem, that these animals don't seem to be scared of anything.
What it is like a tunnel that a rat or a stoat runs through, and it's got a weight trigger, and when it triggers, it gets sprayed with a dollop of poison on its belly.
While poison will play a part in the eradication process, scientists say that biological controls and genetic technology will also be important.
You would be just manipulating slightly the DNA in the pest species, so perhaps you could make it that stoats only gave birth to males, not females. If you had a technique like that, that could be really good.
The fence itself that we're building, a pest-proof fence, is 14.5 kilometres long, enclosing about 700 hectares.
Near the city of Nelson is one of the biggest predator-free enclosures in New Zealand. When the fence is finished, volunteers led by the general manager Hudson Dodd will start removing tens of thousands of non-native predators.
This is extremely rugged country. The valley is heavily forested and its slopes sweep down towards a fast-moving river. Now, this long fence is designed to create a safe haven for native flora and fauna that have been besieged by legions of pests.
I'm an American immigrant to New Zealand, and it reminds me of John F. Kennedy saying, "We're going to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade." You know, when John F. Kennedy said that, there was no plan on how that was going to be achieved. That's really the same situation here. There's no plan about how to make New Zealand predator-free by 2050, but there are a lot of good ideas and a lot of community groups out there doing the hard work to try to bring us closer to that vision.
The head of the Brook Waimarama Sanctuary is Dr. David Butler, who hopes some iconic species will soon be reintroduced here.
Birds like kakapo and kiwi, both of those would have been here in the past. Kiwi we're looking to bring back quite soon, and kakapo are making great strides with a very productive breeding season, so in time, yeah, we hope to have the hills whistling with kiwi and booming with kakapo again.
The New Zealand Prime Minister John Key has called the predator-free program the most ambitious conservation project attempted anywhere in the world.
That's the BBC's Phil Mercer in New Zealand. With all the high-profile races this election season, local down-ballot races can get lost. But voters in the West Valley will be seeing another issue on their ballot on November 8th, asking them to vote yes or no for a $141 million bond to fund WestMEC, or the Western Maricopa Education Center District. WestMEC is a joint technical education district, or a JTED, that aims to prepare 29,000 West Valley students at 46 high schools to enter the workforce. The show's Lauren Gilger spoke with WestMEC Superintendent Greg Donovan about what the bond means and where that money would go.
All of that money goes to improving and adding student programs. We have two campuses which are not yet complete, and so a significant amount of the money goes to those campuses. We currently offer 21 programs where students travel to us. Upon completion of this bond program, we would have 40 programs. So it's a significant addition, and it will also give us some money if we continue to grow over the next 10 years at the rate we have been growing. It would give us the money then to seek another site and to add additional programs.
And you said you just broke ground on a site in Surprise for a new campus?
Yes, our newest campus is located at Dysart and Grand Avenue in the city of Surprise. Upon completion, it will be quite an extensive campus with as many as 17 to 20 different career programs.
And some of this bond money would go to that?
About $50 million of it will go to that campus.
Okay, so it's a sizable chunk. So if this doesn't pass, what happens to that campus?
Well, that campus, we have some money from the previous bond, and that campus would have 5 programs. And we will do the best we can until the community says we're ready for additional opportunity. And at some point then, we would hope the community would support that, and we would be able to grow that site as well as our other sites and other opportunities. We wouldn't do any less. I mentioned we currently have 20 programs. We would continue to maintain those quality 20 programs.
Right. Okay. So will you just have some acreage sitting empty if this doesn't pass?
Yes. we have the acreage ready to go. The previous bond bought the acreage, the ground, but we keep being asked to do more. And so we would like the community's support for our bond election. This is about economic development, and this is about making sure our young people have saleable skills. It is important to go to school and be educated, but we all work for a living, and helping young people select the appropriate career pathway and helping them get on that career pathway benefits all of our community and all of our economics as a community.
So when you talk about JTEDs, you really are talking about the economic development of the state.
Absolutely. Students involved with career and technical education graduate at a 98% rate from high school. The state's graduation rate is currently running about 76%. So being connected in career and technical education adds that relevance that young people say, this is where I want to be. It makes sense to them. It was not education in the abstract. It was education that was hands-on and real. And so all pieces of education began to make sense to that student.
Greg Donovan, Superintendent of WestMEC, thanks for your time.
Have a great day, and thank you for your interest.
The bond would cost homeowners about $6 more a year for property assessed up to $100,000 to fund WestMEC's expansion. ASU and the Mayo Clinic are teaming up in an effort to develop a new model for the country's healthcare system. At a telephone press conference announcing the partnership, Dr. Wyatt Decker, vice president of Mayo Clinic and CEO of Mayo Clinic Arizona, said it's no secret the country faces great challenges in healthcare.
Improving healthcare in the face of this change requires new ways of thinking beyond individual specialties and organizational walls. We have committed to bringing together the brightest minds for accelerating cutting-edge research discoveries, improving patient care through healthcare innovation, and transforming medical education.
For more on this new partnership and how that transformation will take place, I'm joined by ASU President Michael Crow. And President Crow, what's the benefit to ASU of this new deal?
Well, the new ASU Mayo Alliance for Healthcare is really focused on the fact that we need a better set of outcomes. Our healthcare is too expensive. Our health outcomes are not what they should be. And so because of that, we need, in a sense, new ways of doing things. We need new tricks. You know, the old dog needs to come up with some new tricks. And so the way that we do that is rethinking the structure of a comprehensive research university with a comprehensive national clinic. And we say if we bring all of that together in a new kind of way and we build new things and make new things happen, those things can produce better people, better ideas, better outcomes, and hopefully do a better job of enhancing healthcare.
What areas of healthcare and the healthcare field specifically are you hoping that this new arrangement could improve?
We want to work on dramatically affecting community health outcomes. We want to work on lowering cost for healthcare overall. We want to work to produce new types of healthcare leaders, new types of physicians, new types of nurses, new types of scientists, new types of teachers who are skilled in different ways to produce different kinds of outcomes. And so that's where we're hoping to have an impact.
How much of this is coming up with new ways of doing things, and how much of this do you envision as training people to do things a little bit better than they are now?
Well, I think it goes way beyond just doing things a little bit better, because that's not going to be good enough. We've got to come up with, for instance, the new Mayo Medical School that's opening in Scottsdale will focus on the production of an entirely new type of physician, a physician who is obviously scientific and clinical, but also understand supply chain and complexity and economics and, you know, how to enhance healthcare outcomes, how to make better decisions. And so in a sense, it's like, you know, going from, yes, you know how to fly a plane, to flying jets, to flying rockets, to flying, you know, starships. You need a different kind of and a more broadly educated set of people. And so that's one of the things that we're working on.
The entire healthcare system has obviously been undergoing some pretty significant changes over the past several years. Do you see this as catching on to that wave? Do you envision that this might be leading that wave or another wave?
I mean, this is a bow wave alliance, not a catch-up alliance, and that is we're trying to be out developing the new tools, the new methodologies, the new people, the new ideas, the new ways to organize healthcare, the new ways to deal with communities, the new ways to think about nutrition education. So in a sense, we've got to figure out, you know, maybe our teachers aren't educated in the right way to help their students to be nutritionally literate. So maybe we need to rethink that. And so this is way out on the front of the bow wave here.
What kind of time frame are you looking at to be coming up with and then implementing some of these changes?
Well, we launched the alliance after figuring out how to work together. We have dozens of joint projects, joint schools, joint laboratories, joint initiatives, all of that already in place. Now we know how to work together. Now we're moving from that to launching a series of new initiatives and new projects, all of which will begin now. The new medical school opens in July of 2017. New initiatives in other areas are coming online, so that you can just assume that this is going to be continuous and ongoing.
What's the best case scenario in your mind? Like, how big of an impact do you think this could make?
Well, we think, so Mayo Clinic is a national institution and ASU is a national scale university. So we think that we can have national effects. And we think that we can, in the relatively short term, begin to demonstrate how to lower the cost of health care and enhance health outcomes at the same time. And so we think that, you know, the scale is very significant.
ASU President Michael Crowe. President Crowe, thanks.
All right, thanks.
Tempe residents will be able to get an update on their city's streetcar project tomorrow night. Over the past year, it's gotten its environmental clearance and federal funding. Eric Iverson is a principal planner in transportation in Tempe and the streetcar project manager. And Eric, what do you plan to tell residents at tomorrow's public meeting, and what do you expect to hear from them?
Yeah, so we have had several meetings on this project over the last few years. This meeting tomorrow night is to share the status of the project. Those include things like, you know, finalizing the preliminary engineering of the project, which kind of lays out configurations of the track where the rail and track sits in the street, as well as the locations for the stops. And then we also want to share with the public and kind of get them ready for what's going to happen in 2017, which is working with public artists to design the public art elements that will be at the stops, as well as to look at the elements and the direction for the design of the stops themselves.
Have you learned anything from the construction of the Valley's light rail system that you think will help you mitigate some of the potential negative impacts of the streetcar construction project?
Yeah, I think, I mean, as everyone knows, the light rail's been in existence since 2008, and there's extensions that are being planned in other parts of the region, as well as under construction in Mesa right now. So we've been in conversation with Mesa and the other cities in the Valley that have rail. And we're working, obviously, with Valley Metro really closely to minimize the impact to our residents and to our businesses during construction. And, yeah, I think we've gotten better at this. And streetcar is a little bit different than light rail in that the stops are a little bit smaller. The trackway sits in the street, so there's less right-of-way to purchase. So there's kind of less construction impact in general with a streetcar project because it fits into the envelope of your existing street system rather than having to purchase right-of-way and create a whole new separate guideway for the project.
What do you see as some of the similarities and differences between what Tempe will ultimately have and the streetcar system that Tucson has recently unveiled?
I would say there's a lot of similarities, actually. I mean, their project, like ours, connects their business areas or their commercial districts with the university and with redevelopment or, you know, higher density areas, and connects people to the oldest, most historic neighborhoods that we want to protect and preserve. So kind of hits on all those different parts of the city and connecting them. I would say that we are hopeful that our project also has future extensions to it, and I know that is a similarity for Tucson as well. Our ridership numbers would be approximately the same, I think, for opening year like Tucson. So there's a lot of similarities. I think where it's different is that we do have a larger rail system and a larger transit system that this project will connect to. So whereas this was the first rail project down in Tucson, our streetcar project will connect to our regional light rail system in two locations and give people, you know, that greater distance of rail travel options.
Eric Iverson is Tempe's streetcar project manager. Tomorrow evening's public meeting is at 6 at the city's Transportation Center. Before the summer's Paralympics in Rio de Janeiro, we met Arizonan Alyssa Seeley, who was set to compete in the triathlon. Well, she did pretty well. She won the gold medal. Seeley's back in Arizona now, and she joins me to talk about her experience in Brazil. And Alyssa, first off, congratulations on your gold. What was it like for you in Rio?
Thank you so much. Rio was an incredible experience. I spent about 2 weeks there. I raced in the triathlon where I got the gold, and then I raced the next day on the track. And so it was a very, very busy few weeks. And after finishing racing, I got to travel with some friends around the country. So it was a great time.
How did your actual event go relative to sort of how you had pictured it in your mind?
You know, there's very few times you can get a textbook race. But going into the race, I had a plan. I kind of knew where we expected everybody to be. And it really played out exactly how we expected, which made it so easy because I could just follow plan A and I didn't have to come up with plan B or C on the fly.
When you won that gold medal and you were standing on that podium with the flag being raised and the anthem playing, what was going through your mind?
At that point, I still couldn't believe it was all real. I had to keep reminding myself that it wasn't a dream, that this actually happened. I was so proud to be standing up there for, you know, myself, all of the people who've stood behind me for the country, especially on such a special day for us. We raced on September 11th, and so that day has so much more meaning than most other days of the year. And so to be able to stand on the podium and hear the national anthem on September 11th with friends and families and the crowd just cheering, it was something that's so indescribable.
What was it like for you when you crossed the finish line and you realized, hey, I just won a gold medal here?
When I crossed the finish line, I grabbed the banner, I held it up, and then it really took a second to sink in. And when it sunk in, I just kind of held the banner and I looked up to the sky and I was in so much disbelief. I mean, this has been a dream for so many years, a dream that could have been derailed time and time again. You know, even 2 years ago, a lot of people didn't expect me to be there. A lot of people had counted me out. And so to be able to come back from all of that, to stand on the podium, to accomplish a dream that I've had for so many years and worked so hard for, it really was a dream come true.
And I would think that everything you've been through medically, that was just such a vindication of, I guess, sort of your competitive nature and your belief in yourself that, hey, I think I can still do this. You went out and did it.
Yeah, I think when so many people doubted me, having the ability to believe in myself is really what has gotten me where I am and to what I've accomplished. Nobody expected me to ever be an athlete again, and they were very vocal about that. And being the stubborn, hard-headed, you can't tell me no type of person I am, it didn't stop me. It didn't detour me, not even for a second. If anything, it made me more willing to go out and put everything on the line to make it happen.
How has your life changed now that you are a gold medalist and since you've come back from Rio?
In so many ways, it's the same, and in so many ways it's changed. And so I have had a lot of amazing opportunities. I got to meet the president. I've had opportunities to travel. I feel like I've been traveling nonstop since I've been home, to speak to so many different people about the lessons I've learned, about overcoming obstacles and following a dream and really just chasing whatever your gold medal moment is. I mean, it's given me a platform I never thought I would have, but one I'm so appreciative of.
Do you expect or have you thought about whether or not you'd like to compete again in 4 years?
Going into Rio, I said I wasn't sure, but after the past, month, I am definitely going to go for Tokyo. I want to defend my medal.
Alyssa Seeley is a Paralympic gold medalist in the triathlon in Rio. Alyssa, again, congratulations and thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great chatting.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.